Is this on?
Yes, my lord.
Good. Hello, this is God speaking. Can we dial that down?
Yes, my lord.
Thanks. Welcome, new arrival, to the Eternity Ward. Please take a number and make your way down to the left or the right to the waiting room. All you need is the refreshments I made just for you. I would tell you to steer clear of the apples, they're forbidden, and the two snakes. I mean, fools, sorry, that are chewing the fat in the corner, but you probably wouldn't listen anyway. So good luck, I bless you, and on your way.
Welcome to the Eternity Wood, where we flick through old copies of Reader's Digest and chat with our buddies while we wait for an appointment with God. I'm Nick McKinnon.
And I'm Chris Adams. How you going, Dr. Nick? How you going, Dr. Nick?
I'm Dancer Nick tonight, Chris.
Dancing Nick?
Dancer and singing Nick tonight. I've just come back from a performance evening where I wowed the crowd with my theatrical abilities. Or at least that's what it looked like in my mind.
What do you think it looked like in their mind or through their eyes?
Probably a vast array of colourful colours moving in very odd directions.
A vast array of colourful colours?
Oh, yeah. I had a bright red jacket, bright blue shorts, stripy white and blue. No, what? Not blue. That's red. White and red socks. I'm quite artistic, Chris. I'm quite good with my colours. Suspenders, bow tie, rainbow bow tie, and a rainbow wig.
What was your performance?
And a princess tiara, I would like to add.
What was your performance?
We were performing some Justin Timberlake song from the Trolls movie.
Okay, so you were dressed up as a troll.
I was dressed up as a troll, along with 25 other staff from the school I work at.
Wow. Okay. You had some fun.
Needless to say, I was in the back row where I could copy the people in front of me.
Yep. Cool.
How about you, Chris?
Oh, how about me?
Yeah. Were you dressed up as a troll today?
No.
What?
Just my normal work attire.
That's going to make you feel sad.
I already really do feel sad. I don't feel good.
Don't you?
I'm not good, Nick. No.
Is it your teeth?
Well, my teeth is one thing. I did visit the dentist the other day and had 3 teeth extracted.
Who needs teeth?
And 4 patched up. And he did it in like half an hour.
I keep waiting for the day, Chris, where as soon as you're born, the doctors just pull all your teeth out and just like put these fancy metal teeth in that never rot. Like, why doesn't this exist yet?
It's 2017. Come on.
Come on, doctors. What are you doing? I don't want to have to brush my teeth. I've got to check Twitter.
Yeah, it does seem like a bit of a flaw in the design because I've been in a fair bit of pain lately, but I'm on the mend. So, yeah, all is good, Nick. All is good. Actually, no, I'm feeling really depressed, Nick. Very depressed.
Oh, yeah. Thank you, Chris.
Is that leading us into our topic?
Well, that's. I'm glad you came here to the Eternity Ward, Chris.
Oh, okay. Why is that, Nick? Dr. Nick?
Yeah, well, that is the subject of today's episode, Chris. So I'm sure by the end of this 3-hour marathon, we will have you all healed and ready to go meet your maker.
That sounds like you're going to put me down at the end of it.
Well, you know, if there's an afterlife after it and it's all happy days after that, then go for it, Chris.
But you've got to fix me first before I go.
Well, that's my way of fixing you, Chris.
That's your way. You and your pernicious thoughts.
That's right.
Yeah, depression. That's what we're talking about.
That's what we're talking about. And it's something that I think we've both come in fairly close proximity to, you probably more than me.
Why? How close have you come into proximity to depression?
Well, working with young people, it's something that comes up semi-regularly. So I've certainly worked with people that have struggled with it.
Only semi-regularly? Really? I feel like it's a plague half the time.
Do you?
Every corner you turn around, there's more depression and there's more anxiety.
Yeah, but see, you wear normal work attire. I wear troll wigs to work. I keep people happy, Chris.
That's your secret.
Bow ties, Chris. That's my secret. For any of you who don't know me, I wear bow ties very regularly to work every day. The troll wig, less so.
What are we going to say about depression? You normally have questions for me, Nick.
I've got questions for you, Chris.
Yeah, have you got any? Yeah.
Well, I thought we'd just start off at the basic level and
okay.
Kick it off from there. So in your expert opinion, Chris, what is depression?
Depression would be feeling very low down blue for a significant amount of time, so much so that it would disrupt your ability to function normally.
It's not just I wake up in the morning and there's no chocolate in the cupboard and I stub my toe and my favorite TV show isn't on at the moment and the internet's not working. That's not depression.
Well, I mean, you can be depressed about it, but it's not, I guess, clinical depression or not something you'd diagnose as a mental health illness. No. As far as a mental health illness, it's something, I think they say it's something that there has to be a significant amount of time that you're feeling that way, which is, you know, like you feel that way more than you would feel any other way. And it sort of disrupts your ability to get through life as you normally would.
Mm. And so do we have any idea what causes it?
Yes. It's a really complex thing. It could be caused by a whole range of things. So there's like, it could be a genetic thing. We've spoken about genes a lot before here. It could be a biological thing, you know, with your brain chemistry, your neurotransmitters, you know, it's all a bit out of whack. It could be a psychological issue. It could be just the personality issue. There could be sort of like life events or trauma that could sort of set you into suffering from depression, even just things like going through long-term unemployment. But yeah, and deaths, you know, if you have deaths in the family or there's abuse or whatever. So all sorts of things can cause depression.
So those external sources of depression, whether it be, you know, someone dies or whatever, anything external, does that cause the same sort of experience at the level of the brain chemistry as the biological one, the genetic level one, or is it a slightly different experience with those two things?
Yeah. You'd think it'd be similar, otherwise they'd have different labels than all coming under depression. So I'm not sure, but I would imagine it's a slightly different experience, but you'd have to treat it all in a slightly different way.
Yeah.
As such, because you need to address what the root cause is. Maybe the symptoms and the feelings sort of all come together to be fairly similar, but where they come from can be different. You look at a lot in my sort of training, there was always about having a psychosocial environmental response. So you look at the psychology of someone, you look at their social network, their relationships, you look at their environment, and you look at their health, their physical health as well as, so it's their physical health, mental health, social health, everything. It's all encompassing. It's really complicated. So sometimes you can probably even in treating depression, you can sort of underhandedly fix up one person's area of their life, you know, which creates a stronger foundation, even if that isn't the root cause. Mm. I don't know. It's complicated.
I can just imagine that for any depression that is caused primarily by genetics, that in 50 years we will have such a better understanding of the way our brain functions. Like, we are only just scratching the surface of the way our brain functions and what causes what and all that sort of stuff.
Mm.
That whether in 50 years we will just know what levers we need to pull to get everyone who's suffering from that sort of depression back on a normal state of mind just by a really simple drug or whatever sort of medical therapy. Whereas it seemed to me like the external sources, depression would be much more likely to be treated with those sort of conversational therapies that we use.
Cognitive therapy, I think they call it a lot. Yeah.
So what do we have at the moment that can help with depression?
Drugs. Drugs, cognitive therapy, exercise has been to be shown pretty much just as effective as medications.
Because of the hormones and whatever that it releases in your brain?
Yeah, the serotonin and so on. So when you exercise, you're releasing the serotonin. And often if it's a biological issue that you have, you know, you don't have the right chemicals going on in your brain, then exercise can be a really good fix.
Mm.
But medications is one where they sort of keep you put a bit more balance back in your brain chemistry. But if your depression comes from some traumatic event or, you know, from a personality or a psychological issue, that's not going to fix that.
Mm.
But it may still put you in a place where you have the opportunity to be able to face that sort of stuff and fix that because your brain chemistry is a bit more balanced.
Is the medical side of things, is it pretty well understood or is it a bit like educated guessing when they're working out? Like, is there one particular medication they use for most or is it a concoction that they try and work out by trial and error?
Well, I think it's a bit of trial and error. As you said before, it's the brain we're talking about. We don't know that much about it.
Yeah.
I remember when I went on antidepressants like 15, 20 years ago or whatever, they tried me on one brand and that didn't work. They tried me on another one. That didn't work. They tried me on different dosages and then they sort of hit one that they felt was working. So it was a bit of trial and error with different stuff. So I'm sure it's come a long way since then as well. So I don't really know where they're up to with that.
Mm.
But it's still, it's the brain. It's the brain.
I know someone that knows the brain pretty well.
Which someone would that be?
Well, that would be God, Chris.
I would imagine God would know the brain pretty well if God exists.
Can't you just pray to him and be healed? Healing's a thing, isn't it?
Supposedly.
Yeah, there you go. Perfect. There you go, everyone out there. That's all you need. Don't worry about your doctor. They don't know anything.
It does frustrate me when people are healed of something and they...
It frustrates Chris when people are healed.
Let me finish my sentence.
No, it's far funnier if I cut you off, Chris.
All right. Now, just when I see people say, somehow they've been fixed for whatever issue that they had, and they're like, thank God for this healing. And I'm going, you've just walked out of the hospital.
It's magic, Chris. It's not.
At least acknowledge the doctors, you know. So, yeah, some people claim that praying can work. But I was listening to another podcast the other day detailing a pastor who limited his child's treatment of cancer to just prayer, and that was in an attempt to showcase his pure faith, and the child ended up dying. But I guess it can't hurt to pray. I mean, it's actually interesting what the mind...
It can actually, Chris.
Explain?
Have you not heard the Harvard study?
I don't know if I have.
There's a study that Harvard Medical School did about prayer to try and see its effectiveness. And everyone sort of assumed that it would come out that prayer, like regardless of whether there's a God because of the placebo effect, everyone assumed that prayer would prove to be useful. And so what they did, they set up, I think it's three different groups of people. One group of people who were being prayed for and knew they were being prayed for. Another group of people who were being prayed for but didn't know they were being prayed for. And a third group of people who weren't being prayed for, they were the control group. And okay. So everyone assumed the group that knew they were being prayed for would have the better response because just confirmation bias and because of, you know, the power of positive thought and placebo sort of stuff that we know works. We don't understand why it works, but we know it works. And it turned out to be the opposite. And so it turned out that the people that knew they were being prayed for were the group that had the worst outcomes out of the lot, and the other two groups were just the same. And the only hypothesis that seemed to make sense was that if people know they're being prayed for, that they can get anxious about like getting better because they want to prove the people right, or they want to, you know, not disappoint the people that are praying. And so that anxiety actually decreases your ability to get better. That's the only study that I've heard of that's reputable in this sort of area.
Wow.
Yeah, it shocked me. It's one of the things that made me go, holy crap,
because
that's weird.
Yeah, yeah.
So there's no evidence that God is doing any healing. That's certainly true.
Right.
And, you know, that's shocking enough. But the idea that the anxiety of knowing you're being prayed for outweighs any placebo benefit was, I don't know, mind-blowing to me.
Mm. That's sort of not where I was going when I mentioned that surely it can't hurt to pray because I was...
It can hurt to pray.
Well, there you go. I was more going to talk about the sense that our mind can have a certain amount of control in our healing. Like I was reading about a psychologist talking about depression. He was saying that depression, what was his word? Depression arises at its core from a belief that we're powerless to solve our problems. So I really like that. That's what he thinks depression is. But he was saying that it was interesting that they used to think that the mind arose out of the physical brain. So chemical and electrical reactions, all of that going on would give rise to thoughts and emotions. There was a way to prove that, which is, you know, you change the chemical imbalance by putting in like the antidepressant drugs that we've spoken about, and it changes the thoughts and emotions. But due to they've got now these functional MRI scans, this fMRI, and they're proving that the opposite is equally true. If you change your thinking, that actually has a measurable effect and significant effect on the physical brain and its chemistry, which was sort of interesting. So
how do you change the thinking before changing what your brain's doing?
Oh, it's a choice.
But it might be that you can't make that choice without the brain already having that capacity.
But he was saying that through cognitive type therapies, like we were talking before, you sit with someone who's suffering, and like they were working with people who were suffering from phobias, and through cognitive therapy, they could see that the brain pattern of someone with this significant phobia was an abnormal brain pattern. But through the therapy and helping the person to work through it, they were able to change their brain patterns and their brain chemistry. And it, I guess, I don't know when they say brain structure exactly what that means, but from abnormal to normal. So we can rewire our brain with thought. And so the mind can have a significant part to play in managing something like depression, which I just found interesting. He was also talking about depression. It can get triggered pretty easily because we have like 12,000 thoughts a day. And if any one of those little thoughts is something like, I hope people don't laugh at me when I'm dancing on the stage as a troll.
What do you mean by if people have those thoughts? Like, that's like got to be 90% of people's thoughts.
Yes, but any one of those thoughts, if you start to dwell on that and it starts going around your head again, you know, and you go to bed and it shows up, you know, any of those sorts of things can start leaving a mark within your brain. You can start moving towards depression.
Meditation, people. Get on it.
But so I just found it interesting that we have the power to be able to rewire our brain. That doesn't mean that you can't just go, okay, I'm all happy now and I'm better. You still need to go through the logical steps of finding, you know, the root cause of where your depression is or whatever, figuring that out and facing the steps of how do I get past this? What do I do? What do I, you know? And so, but it's about, in a sense, like we've spoken before about beliefs. And so it's about sort of changing your beliefs in a sense. Just in the sense that your beliefs shape your thoughts, which shape your actions. So beliefs are important.
Beliefs are definitely important.
The Buddhists said that the brain and the mind are two sides of the same coin. So maybe they were onto something.
Is there anyone that thinks that they're not? Where else is the mind?
Well, no, just in the sense that some people thought that the mind was more just a product of the brain. Not that they're two sides of the same coin, in that, yes, the brain can affect the mind, but the mind can affect the brain.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, that was my only point.
Good point.
Yeah.
I don't know if I agree with it or not.
Fair enough. Yeah, it's shaky and fertile ground, the debates on mind-brain. I just find it interesting that we're not just slaves to our biological brain, that the mind can exert some power and influence. But, yeah, our brain and or mind can definitely trip us up. Like they say that any of our thoughts can end up with us stuck in our loop and heading to depression. And it's really common depression in those that they say ruminate, those that think.
It's very common in people that think.
Well, but when people who think about the things that they think about, and they think about thinking and they ruminate and they go round and round, which surprises me that you did. So what, have you ever experienced depression, Nick? Because you think about thinking a lot.
I think about thinking a lot.
Yeah. How did you ever not get caught in a depressive loop?
I don't know. So I wouldn't say I've ever had clinical depression. I've certainly never been diagnosed. My wife sent me along to a psychologist to get me checked out one time, and he said, "Nah, you're just a psycho." No, he didn't really say that. He said I had despair, whatever that is, which is somehow different to depression.
That's interesting.
I think the idea with despair is that it's not linked to any physical, chemical stuff that's going on, but it's just you've got an awareness of how messed up the world is, and that's an appropriate response to how messed up the world is, and you just got to find a way through it. That's what the psychologist sort of talked to me about.
Okay.
Like, I've definitely had plenty of dark thoughts, but like nothing. Like, so people that I've heard talk about depression talk about like not being able to get out of bed sort of thing, or finding themselves lying on the floor of their kitchen and just not being able to move. And so, like, I haven't experienced anything remotely like that. Mine, the stuff that I have is all been intellectual, and there's growing up in a religious context and being told that God is good, and then struggling to match that on to what I see in the world and how that made sense, and, well, that it didn't make sense, and that the people that I talked to about it in religious circles didn't engage in the conversation at all. Those are the things that I found really difficult, but that pales into comparison to the stories that I've heard from people around me. Mm. So, no, I wouldn't say I've ever had depression.
Mm. It's interesting you talk about religious people. A UK study found that more depression and anxiety are in people that identify as spiritual. A lot of people experience depression just before or after what they call a spiritual awakening. It's interesting. Yeah, and it's sort of
after, like, one makes sense to me, the before one doesn't make sense to me.
It doesn't? When people talk about, like, the long dark night of the soul, you know, soul searching, I would see that as the before.
Yeah, well, so I've read studies that seemed really counterintuitive to me when I read it, but now that I've read it, it makes sense to me. Like, most people would think that suicide is more common in winter, that they would say that is the most common time for people to commit suicide, but it's not. It's actually spring. So, like, if you're experiencing something terrible, then you sort of work out how to cope with that. But it's when things start to get better, but your feelings don't get better, that you start to go, holy shit, there must be something wrong with me that I am just never going to get out of. And so you actually lose hope. And it's when you lose that hope that I should be getting better, but I'm not, that things crash and that people just can't think of a way out. And so it makes sense to me that if you've had this awesome experience and then when you come down off it, that's when things get ugly. Before it, you're just living your normal life. So I don't really understand the before it part. I'm sure there is an explanation for it, but that's just one that doesn't immediately make sense to me.
All right. I think when you're experiencing depression, it's your body, your mind, or whatever is telling you that there is something, you know, not right. And usually that's we're feeling powerless to solve our problems. For me, I always sort of saw it as, like, we sort of ask these questions of ourselves at significant junctures in our life, which are, who am I? Why am I here? What am I supposed to do? And if you don't get adequate answers, then that can be an issue. So, you know, and those sorts of questions appear again and again, you know, like you get to a midlife crisis, people ask those sorts of questions. It can be a lack of purpose. It can be a lack of direction. You can feel stuck. You can be overwhelmed.
Well, it's just amazing to me that would come before a spiritual experience, though. Like, unless...
Well, what if the spiritual experience is the thing that brings you out of that? You have some sort of spiritual awakening.
But if that were the case, I don't think you would say that it happened before it. I think you would say that it had been happening for a long time and then a spiritual awakening helped me out. But you wouldn't say that it happened before it.
Okay. Well, it was just interesting to hear that they said people who identify as spiritual are generally more empathic, more aware of, you know, the emotions of others around them, aware of the world around them, you know, in miniature, and they're very intuitive, they're very creative often, well, creatives, you know, all of our musicians and poets, and they all have a much higher rate of depression because of this sort of thing. So I don't know, ignorance is bliss, obviously, but it's the people who feel and who think, who experience a lot more depression, you know, often they're searching or seeking. And sometimes depression, I think, is about telling us that we're meant to be searching or seeking for a new way. And if we keep doing the same thing over and over again and expecting a different result, people say that's akin to insanity. And so, like the guy you're talking about before, he's expecting to be better and he's not come spring, and it all comes crashing down. I think depression sometimes is a way of saying we need to change some stuff, because the brain works in a way that when you're making new connections in your brain, new connections, you're learning or you're seeing things in a new way, that gives you all of the serotonin and everything. That's why watching comedy is so much fun. That's why we laugh. We laugh because it's an enjoyable experience to hear someone make a connection between one thing and another thing in a way that we've never heard before. Mm. And it feels good. It's like, oh, that's really insightful, right? That's really clever. We make a new connection in our brain and it feels good. So I think maybe ignorance isn't bliss then. Sometimes if you just if you're just going the same way all the time, they often say that for treating depression, you need to shake some things up. Go exercise, take up a new hobby, start reading, learn something, experience, have experiences.
Start a podcast.
Yes. Well, hey, I said before, I suffered depression. I've been managing it fine for a long, long time, but it never really leaves you. And I found it actually interesting starting this podcast with you, Nick, that I don't know if I was ever a manic depressive in any sort of way, but I'm devoting a lot of time to this and it's feeling really good for my mental health.
We're going to have to cut that bit out, Chris, because we do not want anyone else starting their own podcast because that will be competitors.
But it's being creative. We're being creative. I'm finding that it's giving me some purpose. It's some direction. It's got meaning within it. It's all of these things which help assist my mental health. So thank you, Dr. Nick, for helping me continue to manage my depression, which sits there in the background, out of the back corner of my eye somewhere.
It's the magical bow ties, Chris. So something that you said I was flabbergasted by, Chris.
Which was.
And it's really interesting to me because so in doing these podcasts, you and I do at least a little bit of research so that we don't sound like bumbling idiots. And so it sounds like in your research, the stuff that you've come across shows that there's a correlation between religious belief and increased risks of depression. Which is interesting to me because that's the opposite of what I found, that all the stuff I came across showed that there was a link between depression and atheism. Ah. And it's interesting that you, the religious person, connected with those studies and I connected with these ones. So I wonder if there's some sort of confirmation bias going on that you actually want to find that and I actually want to find the evidence that I found.
You think we'd be looking for the opposite. But what did you find?
Well, so I came across a number of studies that talk about the link between atheism or a lack of religious belief and depression. There's one study I looked at that showed that religious participants were 25% less likely to suffer depression than irreligious people.
We're finding all of these contradictory reports. It's weird.
So when I saw these studies, the thing that goes through my head is, holy crap, you and I are recording this podcast and I'm raising all these questions about religious belief and belief in God and maybe in doing so, I'm going to be increasing the risk of depression in some people. Like you sort of mentioned earlier a similar quote, but I came across this quote by George Bernard Shaw, who was an atheist, and along this topic, he said that a drunken man is happier than a sober one. So if someone thinks that there's a loving God that always loves me, well, you know, of course that's going to make you feel better about things. And so even if he's wrong, a drunken man's happier than a sober one.
Mm. Yeah, but you'd have to stay drunk.
But also saw some other stuff that, I don't know if you'd call them studies, but I guess thoughts, that these may very well be people who are atheists trying to explain their findings in a way that makes them feel better about themselves. So we know that there's a lot of evidence that shows that increases in depression is related to higher IQs. So the higher IQ you have, the more likely you are to suffer from depression.
I did read that.
And we also know that higher, I don't know if you agree with this, but this is something that I've seen over and over again, that higher IQs also correlates with atheism and a lack of belief in a supreme being.
No, I haven't seen that one.
If those two things are both true, then it would make sense that atheism would be linked with higher rates of depression. But obviously you haven't seen that one.
No, I didn't see that. But yeah, I can see some credibility to it. There are multiple types of intelligence, but where IQ is intellectual intelligence, you know, people who are very heady, yeah, I could believe that.
Well, here's something for you. There was also another study that I saw that showed that people who meditate regularly also have thicker areas of cortex in important regions linked to combating depression, I suppose, or not being a high risk of depression. And that was regardless of whether they went to church or not. So they asked people whether they went to church and looked at how often they meditated, and the church thing didn't seem to have as big an impact, but meditation did. So if you meditated regularly, that those people had larger, thicker areas in the cortexes that seemed to matter. So now they weren't sure which way the causality ran there, whether it was that the meditation caused the thicker cortexes, or whether it runs the other way, where people with thicker cortexes were more likely to meditate just because that's the direction that their brain pushed them. But I found that interesting.
Mm. Was Charles Darwin an atheist? He was for some of the time. Some people say he recanted on his deathbed.
You mean like when he didn't have full capacity to think? Yeah, that's a shock.
But he went through depression himself.
And did he? I didn't know that.
He suffered from a whole bunch of mental illnesses, depression being one, agoraphobia being another.
Well, what's agoraphobia?
That's when you have panic attacks if you're in an environment that you don't feel safe within. So a lot of people will end up not even leaving their house. But obviously he left his house. He went all over the world. He had suicidal thoughts. There was, he wrote, "You ask about my book, and all that I can say is that I'm ready to commit suicide. I thought it was decently written, but find so much wants rewriting. I begin to think that everyone who publishes a book is a fool."
I agree.
Because he was someone that ruminated a lot. He would think a lot. And Charles Darwin was one that found it very hard to get out of bed, apparently. You know, like, you end up in this weird cycle where insomnia, you're having trouble sleeping, and that can lead to depression. And one of the side effects of depression is that you can't sleep. When I was suffering depression, I was not able to get to sleep at the beginning until like 1 a.m. And then it'd be like 1:30 the next night, and then 2 the next night, and then 2. It throws out your clock, and then it's 3, and then it's 4, and then you're up all through the night and you can't sleep. You end up spiraling further and further into this depression, and you can't get out of bed. You can't move. You can't face the world. You can't function. Can't hold down a job.
And along the same lines, one of the things that helps depression is physical activity. Yep. But if you've got depression, you can't be bothered.
Yeah. Yeah. Everything, absolutely everything becomes an effort.
All the things that could help you are too much effort.
When everything is an effort, that becomes really draining. You know, it can be too much of an effort to get up and go to the toilet. There are people that will just wee in a bottle in their room rather than come out, you know. I mean, have you heard about the thing that's been happening in Japan? With what they call the hikikomori.
I haven't heard enough about hikis, so tell me.
Hikikomori. There's actually a term to this phenomenon, which is happening in Japan with a lot
of...
Can I
take a guess before you continue?
Yeah, sure.
Is it people who end up dying because they play video games too much?
No.
Oh, poop.
But there might be something to that. You might be close.
I heard of a Korean dude that died because he just didn't get up and eat and drink.
Yeah, that does happen. But the hikikomori are young people who completely withdraw from society. They spend their life in their bedroom. Their parents push their food under the door, and they're just so reclusive. They spend their life, I guess, interacting on the internet. But they've completely withdrawn, and it's happening to a lot of people in Japan. But I also found all of this really contradictory information when I was researching, like, the country that has the least amount of depression in the world, Japan. Then they've got this thing called hikikomori.
So when they do it well.
That's right. Where do you think is the number one most depressed country in the world?
I would go with the US.
Yeah, I used to have this theory that it was more of a Western society sort of thing. Like, we have everything. We have all of these material things. We have access to health and everything. We have all of these educational opportunities, but somehow we're lacking a purpose. And, you know, maybe you look at a nation in Africa that's really poor, and even though they have nothing, at least the child has to go and forage for food to keep their family alive, and that gives them purpose. And so they won't have this depression that we have, you know.
But you can't have time to be depressed when you're too busy looking for food and water.
Well, I was thinking that was the case, but the more I...
It's not true.
Yeah, the more I explored it, Afghanistan, number one country for depression. North African countries, really high up there, seriously really high. USA, really high up there as well, I might add. I also used to believe somehow, for some reason back in the 80s, that Australia was like number one in the world for a suicide rate or something, but I couldn't find any evidence that that existed. But we do have between 15 and 44 year olds in Australia, the leading cause of death is suicide.
So more than car accidents.
More than car accidents. There's 2,800 per year. Nearly eight a day. Does that not sound like a lot? How many is car accidents?
2,800. Not in a country with 20 million people. That seems like a very small amount. Well, maybe I'm more of a pessimist than you, Chris.
Well, that was the thing. Like, I thought Australia would be ranked really high on the depressed countries and on the suicide rate, and we don't. We're 87th or something on the most depressed countries. So we're...
right in the middle.
Yeah.
Cool. Go us. Yeah, likewise. In doing research for this, I was... like, one of the things that I thought we were going to be talking about was the link between depression and suicide and wealth, but it just didn't exist. It shocked me. Yeah, like, there are a bunch of Middle Eastern countries and Asian countries that had high rates of depression, and I was shocked.
Yeah, I mean, we still have a high, 45% of people in Australia will have some sort of mental health condition in their lifetime. There's about 1 million people diagnosed with depression at a time and in Australia, and 2 million diagnosed with having anxiety, I think, something like that. So it's actually more likely for females to be depressed, but males are twice as likely to commit suicide. No, three times more likely to commit suicide.
But I've heard that, like, I've heard those stats too, but I've also heard that when attempting suicide, men are more likely to succeed in their suicide. Now, that's not that men actually want to and women don't actually want to, but just the ways that men try to commit suicide are always successful. So if you use a gun, you're going to succeed. And if you drive your car off a cliff, well, that's going to work. Whereas women do other things where you can be found before you actually die.
Yeah.
So that's one of the wrinkles that I've heard of change that. But yeah, I've heard the same sort of statistics.
You ever had suicidal thoughts before, Nick?
I've certainly had thoughts of not wanting to be here, not wanting to be on Earth, not wanting to exist, but I never got to the stage of making a plan. As someone who's worked with young people, that's one of the things that you look for, is whether someone's made a plan and worked out, thought about who would find them and all that sort of stuff. And the more I've learnt about it, the more I've thought, no, I was never really anywhere near committing suicide. It's one of the things that I found challenging at the start, and I think everyone does, is talking about suicide, that it can be a really difficult thing to force yourself to say to a person, have you thought of committing suicide? Have you thought of killing yourself? It's just one of those difficult sentences that you sort of have to force yourself to say, even though everything in you is saying, I don't want to have this conversation. This is difficult.
I originally sort of didn't want to have those conversations because I was scared that you may maybe be putting that thought into their head, you know, but in all the training I've received since, it's no, you need to ask those questions, and you need to establish whether they actually do have a plan and whether they've got some idea of how they might. And people will tell you generally.
Yeah.
Whereas, yeah, so many people end up committing suicide without having told anyone because no one has asked them that question. I've had friends die from suicide, so yeah.
Have you ever had someone react negatively from asking that question? From asking them whether they've thought about killing themselves? I've never had anyone.
Never. I've asked that question many, many times. I've asked it this week. And I've never had anyone get really upset that I asked them that question.
What's the most common reaction?
The most common reaction would probably be a bit like what you said yourself, you know, in that they've thought about suicide, or they don't want to be here, but they haven't actually. The most common reaction is they haven't figured out how they're going to do it, and they haven't really gone through the process of trying to really do it. And a common response is yes. Have you thought about suicide? Yes. That's a common response. But the more you explore it, the more it's like you don't actually think they're suicidal, but they have had suicidal thoughts.
The most common response I've come across is one of relief, that the person is just like, thank God someone has brought this up because I didn't know how to bring it up with someone.
Yeah.
Because, like, if you're suicidal, it's got to be hard to breach that conversation with someone, to work out who you can talk about this to. Because often when you're depressed, I've had people say things like, I didn't want to burden you with my troubles, and I don't think that I'm all that important, and that I didn't want to waste your time by talking about this stuff, because they already feel so low about themselves that they don't even think they're worthy of anyone else's time. Relief and appreciation are two things. Well, appreciation is probably too strong a word, but along those lines are the things that I've experienced.
Hmm. Where does the conversation head to after they've expressed that relief? And, you know, how do you keep talking to them about that topic?
So it's guided by their answer. It's guided by the severity of how far down the track they are, how concerned I am that they actually might want to go through with it and kill themselves. And so at the extremes, you're talking about things like, actually, this is a pretty common one for me, is getting them to sign a suicide contract, which is just a written contract where the person writes down, I promise that if these thoughts get so bad that I feel like killing myself, I'm going to do this, this, and this. And so generally you'll have the phone number of someone that they can call and talk to before they do it. And just having put in their head that they have made a commitment that before they do it, they will do a certain few things can be the thing that stops them from doing it. Because before they do it, they still have a sense of not wanting to hurt other people. These are not people that have lost any care about other people. It's just that they've lost care of themselves in a sense. And so if you can convince them that they need to do these things or they're breaking their word, then that can be a really helpful thing. It can be a roadblock to them completing their suicide. There's, you know, the obvious things of giving them the phone numbers of Kids Helpline or Lifeline or those sort of services. There's just the basic stuff that we talked about before about physical exercise. And actually, one of the things that we didn't talk about before is helping other people. That if you can get outside your own head and focus on someone else and focus on their needs, then that can go a long way. And I think that's a lot of the reason that both you and I have gone into these sort of professions where we're helping people, because it it helps us.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's exactly how I sort of got past my own depression. So I was at the stage where I couldn't get out of bed. And depression's sort of illogical. It's you sort of tell yourself a whole lot of lies. You live with a whole lot of shame and guilt that doesn't need to be there. You know, it's just you believe all of these lies. You think you're worthless. Actually, my depression was sort of, in a sense, you might find this interesting, religiously related, in that I was too scared. I'd sort of screwed up my life so much that I thought I was destined for hell, probably.
The prodigal son.
And I was too scared to interact with other people, because what if I spoke to them and I somehow inadvertently influenced them, because I would corrupt them somehow and that they would end up going to hell? And we're sort of talking about that before, about you were saying, oh, maybe I'm leading people into depression.
Yeah.
Right? You know, by the things that I'm talking about. And so that was my greatest fear, was I couldn't talk to anyone. I could barely talk to a shopkeeper to buy anything. I was a mess. And I remember the day I sort of turned the corner. I was just lying on the couch in my house and a sun shower went through, and I was just staring at a tree outside, the sun glinting through all the raindrops in the tree. And I'm just marveling at this tree, and I'm going, how does this tree work? It's this solid thing, but it somehow it soaks up the water through its, and how long does it take for all of the moisture to end up going through the solid trunk of the tree and to the leaves? And I was just, the whole structure of this tree, I was just awestruck by it all. And I was, I guess, making new connections in my brain as I was thinking about it. And I went, oh, I do love things about this world. And I don't want to be depressed anymore. So for me, it was, and that's one of the big issues I see, is that people start defining themselves by their mental illness. And so I'd sort of, I would tell everyone I'm depressed. I suffered depression. So you spend so much time maintaining this picture of yourself that this is who I am, that you can't even break out of it. So I didn't want to define myself by that anymore. So, okay, yeah, I'm Chris. That's who I'm defining myself as now, and I manage my depression. So that was a turning point. I then moved. I moved from Brisbane, moved to Tasmania, that tiny little island at the bottom of Australia. And
it's not at the bottom, Chris, it's at the top. You're just reading your map upside down.
Yeah, that's true. Just saying, it's all about perspective and north and south. They're just, well, it's just relative.
Yeah.
But I it was a bit of a road then with, you know, antidepressants and also rediscovering my faith at the time, which, so whether that's using God as some sort of crutch to work my way out of it, or whether that's a spiritual awakening, or, you know, it felt like a spiritual awakening, but it was a significant moment for me. But I think the real healing came, I mean, that gave me hope, that gave me some direction. But the real healing for me was when I chose to take on a role, which was being a chaplain. I was freaked out about it. They said, "We want you to be a chaplain at this high school." And I'm like, but that means talking to people and influencing people who I could corrupt at any second of the day and send them. No, I can't do that. That's the scariest thing that I could imagine. And they always talk about depression as like this black dog. That's the term they refer to. It's this little monster that you create. And I think for me, it was facing that monster and putting myself in a situation where I then learnt that, yeah, the things I say are going to influence people. And maybe some of the things I say will have a negative impact, but I have to try my best to just not talk to people because you're scared of what might result. That's ridiculous. That's illogical. So it was about trying my best, and through helping other people, through getting outside of my own head, like you're talking about. And that's a big thing, is if you're sitting with someone and you're listening to them tell you about all of their troubles, they don't need you to be bringing your troubles into the room as well. You know, so you have to leave all your stuff at the door. And I think the more you end up sort of leaving all of your stuff at the door, the easier it gets to leave it behind. So through helping others, I think they help me more than I help them in one sense. But I think depression is, you sort of inhabit this tiny world, and in that tiny world, it's just you and you don't like you very much. And if you can focus outside of that tiny world, then, well, that was a big thing for me. And haven't really looked back. But it's still, you know, it rears its head every now and then. That's why I need this podcast.
It's amazing to me that you talk about depression as being this thing where you're consumed with your own mind. The thoughts just keep reverberating in your own mind. And you're sort of retreating from the world into your mind. And yet one of the things that can really help is meditation, which in a sense is retreating even further into your mind, to the point where you're only concentrating on your breath or on like one very specific thing, because in doing so, it helps center you into one specific moment in time and not letting yourself get caught up, not letting those thoughts in your brain keep circling, but instead forcing them to focus on one specific thing.
Yeah, that's why mindfulness is that sort of thing, that whole being in the moment. You know, I've spoken before about, for me, that's about trying to find the eternal moments where you have that conversation with someone that really means something and you're centered in that moment. Yeah, those sorts of things give me a reason to live. I mean, they make living worthwhile. And I think if you're suffering from depression, it's hard to find living worthwhile. Where are you going to find the meaning and the purpose and the direction? And I mean, but yeah, there's all sorts of different depressions and there's different ways of treating them. But yeah, for me, it was facing down the monster, putting myself in a situation where I couldn't just retreat and be reclusive, because that would be my natural inclination to do so. And it still always is my natural inclination. And I know that about myself. I know that I have to put myself in situations where I can't do that anymore. And I know when the depression's starting to show that I need to go and be sociable. Do I have to be sociable? Or I need to be creative. I need to sit down and draw. I know certain things that help me manage. But it's hard seeing all of these young people at the moment. It feels like a plague. It feels like more and more and more all the time. I'm like, what is with this generation? Why? Where is their resilience? I find it helpful that I went through depression, in that I can work with other people who are finding it hard to go through that as well.
Marriage, that helped as well.
You know, my wife has probably helped me a lot through managing my, I don't know how she put up with me sometimes when it was, had more control of me than I had more control of it. Having the people around you that help create, you know, a strong foundation for you to be able to tackle the problems that you need to tackle.
Yeah.
So having the friends and the family, and or if not that, then access to places like Beyond Blue, Headspace, Kids Helpline, all of those things, yeah.
The problem with saying that marriage is a really helpful thing is that people can then hold that up as, I'll be happy when I get married. And the problem is that you get married and it's good for a year and then reality kicks in and no human being is perfect and no relationship is perfect and there's going to be plenty of hard times that come.
And all the people who think that having a baby is going to fix their relationship or
that
their life.
That is a stupid idea.
It happens so much though, Nick.
It does, yes. I'm sure this is not true for everyone, but I think for my wife and I, it took us 7 or 8 years, something like that, for us to find our groove in our relationship. And before that, there were a lot of ups and downs.
Well, I was just thinking, like, in my relationship, there was a part of me which wanted to wait until... I have to wait for the dog now.
The black dog?
Yeah, the black dog drinking the water. You're right. In my relationship, there was a part of me which wanted to wait until I had all of this stuff managed and completely sorted out before I'd be ready to embark on this adventure called marriage. But if I had have waited, I'd still be waiting. Sometimes you have to go when you're not ready and work on it as you go, and that creates some hard times as you go. But yeah, I'm just thankful for the people around me. They put up with me and I've been managing it really well. Yeah. And so I try and be that person to others that I see that are struggling with it, that maybe don't have some of that structure around them.
I think that's one of the things that I try to instill in people that I come across who are suicidal, just highlight to them the connections they have with other people and how killing themselves will affect other people. Because often people that are suicidal just think so lowly of themselves that they think that no one cares about them. And there's this quote by Tim Ferriss. I don't know if you've heard of Tim Ferriss. He's a bit of a self-help guru in a good sense of the word, not in a rah-rah, you can do it sort of dude. Actually, one of the things he talked about is the four-hour work day or week. I don't know if it was week or day, but the idea that actually reducing the amount that you work can actually increase your productivity, which is
it does
sort of counterintuitive.
It does. It's been proven.
Yeah. So anyway, he's this dude. So he writes these books. He has a podcast, which you're not going to check out because ours is good enough for you. He struggled with suicidal thoughts for a long time. And well, I guess still does, because you don't really outgrow it in a sense. But so he had this quote in one of his books that he wrote. He wrote this book called Tools of Titans. And one of the bits he talked about was depression. And he said in it that killing yourself can spiritually kill other people, that your death is not perfectly isolated. It can destroy a lot, whether your family or other loved ones who will blame themselves, or simply the law enforcement officers or coroners who will have to haul your death mask wearing carcass out of an apartment or the woods. The guaranteed outcome of suicide is not things improving for you, but creating a catastrophe for others. That this is the reality, not the cure-all fantasy of suicide. And I love that idea that we need to be upfront with people that are suicidal and say there are real consequences to you killing yourself, that there will be people that will be affected. And you might not see that because you just feel so poorly about yourself. But even if it's true that there is no one that loves you, and you probably wouldn't say that to someone that's suicidal, but even if it's true that there is literally no one in the world that loves you, then at the very least, there's going to be law enforcement officers that are going to struggle a lot from dealing with what you put them through. And like most people that are suicidal are not uncaring people. Like, yeah, there'll be your suicide bombers who are uncaring, like, but not your everyday teenager who's depressed.
It's often they care too much.
Yeah. So putting that thought in their head that it's not all about them and that it will affect other people.
Yeah, I just always want to try and get someone into a situation where they're helping other people.
Yeah. Like
we talked about, if they can get out of their own head and be helping others, because I don't know whether this is just some evolutionary trait or some intended way that we were meant to be, but I think that when we are helping other people, it helps us. It helps everyone. It's a win-win situation. Everyone benefits. And I love that feedback loop.
Yeah.
When we're not being selfish. I love that.
Yeah. And
it works.
And I love that I was at a leavers assembly I don't know, 5 or 6 years ago. And there was this dude doing one of those motivational talks. He just started asking people in the audience what they wanted to do with their lives. And we started it off with that, what you want to do with your life. And people were saying things that I certainly for me, I won't speak for anyone else, but for me, when I first heard it, I thought they're pretty superficial things, like I want to be a hairdresser or like things like that. And I thought, well, that's not very exciting, is it? But then his follow-up question was, why do you want to do that? And at that question, like this is like a grade two kid or something, grade two boy. And his response was, because I want to make people feel better about themselves. And I just love that. How good's that?
Yeah.
And so I was just like, God, you're an idiot, Nick. This little grade two kid's, he's brilliant. That's awesome. So it doesn't matter what you're doing. You can do any job.
Yeah.
But you can dedicate yourself to helping people through that.
Yeah, it's how you do that job. Yeah.
One of our mutual friends, Daniel Townsend, wrote a song that had the lyrics in it. Everyone wants to, I don't know what the word there is, but everyone wants to help the poor or something, but no one wants to pick the rubbish off the street. All of us want to do the big grand things, but none of us want to do the little mundane stuff because we don't recognize it as being helpful when it really is.
Well, talking about helping people in an intuitive sense, even from a child's sort of sense, I don't know, I think that's a helpful way to close off this podcast, Nick.
Yeah, I think you summed it up nicely.
It's a good place to leave it.
Go out there and help people, people.
Yeah, Dr. Nick says so.
Dr. Nick is not a doctor and doesn't know anything.
You did your research?
Yeah, I did. And confirmation bias kicked in, apparently.
Thank you again for listening. Hope this has been helpful in some way for you. It is for me. Yay!
And it is for me.
Bye.
Farewell.
Again, and I concur. Do help one another. Ask someone if they're okay. Ask yourself, and if not, Google Lifeline, Beyond Blue, Headspace, or Kids Helpline. Look after yourselves, you lovely, loved people. And if you've got something out of this episode and want to support the ongoing mental health of Chris and Nick, like, subscribe, join the conversation, and come back again to the Eternity Ward.